Thanks, Kuvehi. You know, 2018 is already one of the deadliest years for Hawaii pedestrians in the last decade. There have been 30 fatalities statewide this year compared to 15 last year and 32 in 2016. Last weekend alone, there were 3 pedestrian fatalities, 2 on Oahu and 1 on Kauai. A 4th person was hospitalized in serious condition after a separate incident in Honolulu. Of those 30 deaths, 23 were on Oahu. Last time at this year, there were only 4 fatalities on Oahu. That increased that has led the Honolulu Police Department to scramble to change the behavior of both drivers and pedestrians. Officer Ben Moskowitz is the captain of HPD's traffic division.
Of the 23 pedestrians, 6 were in crosswalks. So it's not the classic car plus pedestrian in crosswalk that we're having a rash of. We have had at least 3 that have been negligent homicide, failure to render aid cases, where we have drivers that hit pedestrians on the side of the road and flee in rural areas. We've had 4 where we've had pedestrians walking on the freeway at bizarre hours of the night. We've had 2 in the last 2 weeks where we've had someone laying on the ground at the entrance to a parking garage, either one going out and one coming in the last couple of days. It's, again, I've said this before, but it's kind of hard to nail down. It's hard for us to say there's any one particular factor that we could address. That having been said, we are stepping up enforcement efforts. We did an operation today where we have pedestrian officers dressed in plain clothes who are pedestrians in marked crosswalks, and we're pulling people over and issuing citations and warnings to those folks. It's not something that we like to do, again, to go out and give citations, but it's something that we feel we need to start the conversation, right? You guys saw the traffic message boards, and it said, don't be a low-low driver, and everybody saw the low-low drivers, the sign. My wife hated it. But I'll tell you, that evening, my wife and I were standing in our kitchen talking about pedestrian safety and traffic safety. And I'm a traffic cop, so you'd think we'd talk about that all the time, but we don't. So it's we need to start the conversation, and we need to have people talking about it. So that's mainly the reason we're out doing enforcement, is to keep it top of mind.
According to Moskowitz, about half of reported incidents are treated as criminal.
All the cases where our investigators find some sort of negligence on the part of the driver, those are all cases that we investigate and then we confer. We actually investigate all of our cases regardless. And that's part of the reason that even if we have a crash where it looks like obviously maybe the pedestrian is at fault, we still respond, we still do a full investigation, we still look for witnesses, we still recover videotape, we still interview people because we want to make sure. And if it turns out that there is some sort of criminal liability on the part of the driver or the pedestrian or the bicyclist or the motorcyclist, then we proceed with those cases to the prosecutor's office. Some they take, some they don't, but we take care of all of them.
Uniform and plainclothes officers have been at street corners and in crosswalks all week, testing drivers and walkers. Many are simply handing out warnings or informational pamphlets to remind pedestrians of crossing laws, but citations have been issued to jaywalkers and drivers who fail to properly stop. The State Department of Transportation is also conducting outreach to try and change behavior. Lance Ray is with the DOT's Walkwise Hawaii Pedestrian Safety Campaign.
The number one reason for pedestrian crashes is inattentive behavior, both on the part of the driver and the pedestrian. We're just not paying attention to each other, and we need to change the way we walk, and we need to change the way that we drive. As drivers, we have to remember that our primary task is to get from point A to point B safely. We need to keep our eyes on the road, we need to keep our hands on the steering wheel, we need to keep our mind on the primary task of driving. We have a tendency to speed as drivers. We need to slow down and beware of pedestrians. And as pedestrians, we also need to remember that we need to be visible day and night. The majority of pedestrian crashes occur between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. when visibility is low. We need to be visible. And also as pedestrians, we always walk the quickest way to our destination and not the safest way. If you are walking along the side of the roadway and there is no sidewalk on this side, but there's a sidewalk across the way, go to the sidewalk and walk that way. Find the safest route, not the easiest route. At Walkwise Hawaii, we want to change the way we drive and the way we walk. We'd like you to reach out to us so we can come into your community and teach the citizens to be better walkers and to be better drivers in conjunction with pedestrians. You can call us at 808-535-9099 to schedule a free presentation where we can educate seniors, students, as well as the general public.
Again, the problem of pedestrian fatalities far worse on Oahu than other islands. We mentioned that Oahu has seen 23 fatalities this year. All the other islands combined have seen 10. And in an update to a story we were tracking yesterday, the Honolulu City Council voted to pass two controversial bills that would give the city additional authority to remove persons and property from public spaces like sidewalks and parks. Now, the measures are seen by many as targeting Oahu's urban homeless population, though it may help curb vendors operating on Waikiki sidewalks as well. Mayor Kirk Caldwell wholeheartedly endorsed both measures, saying city officials needed more authority to address the problem of chronic homelessness. Advocacy organizations decried the move as criminalizing homelessness. But last-minute controversy arose when members of the council inserted language that would allow for the delay or to block implementation of the bill, even though it's signed into law. Councilmember Ikaika Anderson of Windward Oahu voted no for that reason.
I'm gravely concerned by the last line that's been offered in the floor draft that says subject to acceptance of the report by the council, because I'm not exactly sure when that's going to be. And people in my council district chair, the people from Windward Oahu who have elected me, have been sharing for a long time their views that we should move forward in an expeditious manner to return all of our public sidewalks to the public. And in passing this legislation, it would seem that that would happen in an expeditious manner. But because of that final line in this floor draft, that may not be. I'm open to consider similar legislation going forward. If there was a definitive date, I would be okay. But being that there is no definitive date, Chair, I'll be voting no at this time.
Councilmember Kimberly Pine from West Oahu has previously opposed similar bills like sit-lie bans because many of those targeted end up in her community. On these measures, she voted yes but expressed reservations.
In my district, homelessness, since these sit-lie bills have been implemented, has increased to 20%. My district, from Ewa Beach to the Waianae Coast, has more shelters, more transitional housing, more special programs than any other district combined. Because we are the place that for many decades have welcomed people that don't have much with open arms and love. But when I see those aunties and uncles and grandmas and grandpas who have traditionally for a generation fed those who have not had much, with so much love, finally tell me, Kim, please, we cannot help anymore because we can now barely help ourselves because there's just too many to help. Sadly, with all the loving people that have come into our community, sometimes when you have light, you also have darkness. We have had crime increase in so many areas. We have had crimes against children, the elderly. We have had beautiful parks and beaches and streets and neighborhoods destroyed overnight by vandals that are truly lost. Will this bill help? No, I don't think so.
Bill 52 passed the council on a 6-3 vote, but retained that requirement for 9 additional studies to be performed before enforcement can begin. Now, Mayor Caldwell, he reacted to the vote via Twitter, saying, even though the city council passed bills 51 and 52, they did not delink the need for a comprehensive homeless study before enforcement begins. Even with my signature, enforcement will be delayed. The public is crying out for help in clearing sidewalks for their own safety. Thank you so much, Kuvehi and Wayne. This is The Conversation. You know, it was back in April when Kauai was first hit by flash flooding, and there have been other problems with the most recent storms. One person died, and many homes and businesses were affected by the bad weather. A grant to help displaced workers is now available through the State Labor Department. If you live on the Garden Isle and were affected, the state's Workforce Development Council wants to hear from you. We talked to the Department of Labor's Kayla Rosenfeld about an upcoming meeting next week to help affected workers find jobs and to help recovery efforts.
The Kauai grant is the one that we have one more community meeting. That will be October 11th from 1 to 3 p.m. in Hanalei. That'll be at the Hale Halawai Center. And it's a community meeting to introduce the grant, the provisions, so what is it? what is a dislocated worker, who qualifies, and how you can come in as an individual dislocated worker or as a business of record which would employ a dislocated worker. So that's what the meeting is that's coming up on the 11th, is to explain how somebody can become involved in the program.
Okay, so you're part of this rapid response team, and, you know, we've done many stories on, you know, the fact that you folks are there reaching out to the folks in need, because we've got this pot of money that you'd like to get into the hands of people who are eligible.
Correct. That's exactly right. So the first thing is we need to determine if an individual is eligible to participate in the grant. So if you are an individual who, as a consequence of the disaster, so let's talk about Kauai right now, as a consequence of the April flooding, if you are now temporarily unemployed or underemployed, so if you are working less hours than you were before the flooding, or you've been laid off because of the flooding, you are eligible under this grant to receive workforce assistance. There's also a component for a self-employed individual who became unemployed or significantly underemployed as a result of the flooding. Okay, so individuals and self-employed business people qualify, potentially qualify as eligible under this grant. So to determine that qualification, we do have some documentation that is required. And for the individuals, that documentation would be, first and foremost, if somebody's received the disaster unemployment assistance, they call it DUA, D-U-A, that is the most solid documentation. If an individual can walk into our American Job Center, which I'll address in a moment, with that documentation, they essentially are eligible for this grant. If they don't have the DUA, the Disaster Unemployment Assistance, then they're going to need to provide us pay stubs or payroll records, something that indicates that they are earning less than they were prior to the April flooding. What I really want to get out is that any documentation an individual has that can demonstrate, prove that they are working less or earning less than they did prior to the disaster, that's the materials you want to gather.
Okay. And then if they don't bring these to your meeting, can they submit them later?
We're going to have a remote intake unit set up at the meeting. So if they can have all of those documents, we will do our best to take care of all the processing there. If they're unable to do that, they're going to need to make an appointment to visit the American Job Center in Lihue. So what I've done is I've taken the center from Lihue and made it a remote session for this briefing.
Do folks have any idea how many people might be affected?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't know. I can tell you that we had 13 people from Kauai visit our first briefing that we had. That was on the 25th of September. We had 13 people attend the briefing. We signed up one business of record and a couple of individuals. So the word still needs to get out that this is available.
Okay.
So I'm really, really hoping that individuals who believe they are impacted by the flooding and considered a dislocated worker, I really hope that people will come out and just figure out if they're if they're eligible or not, because we have this cash that we'd like to share.
So how much would someone be eligible for? How much are we talking about?
So it's not just an outright you get cash. It means that you are coming in and you're going to be put to work. It's called temporary employment. Each individual is permitted 1 year of temporary employment, 2,080 hours, literally. And then the rate of payment, your wages, is based on whatever the prevailing wage is for that job in that industry. And on paper and anecdotally, we know the work needs to be done, but gathering the troops in order to make it happen is the challenge. So that's why we're holding these community briefings. We want to invite the community, invite businesses to come forward and open their doors to dislocated workers. The challenge is that the business that comes forward and we want to register as a, quote, business of record, we will pay the salary of the individuals who they take on, but the work itself must be disaster recovery work, and it falls into specific categories. Can I tell you those categories?
Sure.
So this is called allowable grant activity. This is work sites are limited to public and private nonprofit facilities. Cleanup and recovery is conducted on facilities and lands located within the disaster area and in offshore areas related to the emergency or disaster. So that's the language. The temporary jobs that we are able to provide this workforce funding for must be related to the following activities. That would be demolition, repair, renovation and construction, and emergency nonprofit case management. And that last one is a humanitarian category. So again, all jobs must be categorized within those categories: demolition, repair, renovation, and reconstruction, and a humanitarian side is the emergency nonprofit case management.
Okay, some people might be wondering, why are they just hearing about this now?
Well, that is a challenge of the grant, is that the monies are federally allocated, so it takes time to first of all determine at our state level and county level in this case, do we have a situation that triggers an emergency, triggers a proclamation? So it has to go up the chain, and then by the time it gets to the governor who submits the proclamation, there's different kinds of FEMA proclamations that will trigger. For example, the very first one would be, you know, FEMA has permission to move forces around for life-saving purposes, so move people, move equipment. This grant comes with a secondary declaration, which is for public assistance. So we couldn't get the grant. We couldn't even apply for the grant until we got the public assistance declaration from FEMA.
Gotcha. So it's a process.
It's a process. Okay. It's a federal process. Mm-hmm. Anybody who wants to participate in this grant first has to go to our American Job Center to be determined eligible. And then after being determined eligible, you'll be taken to the staffing agency, which is HI Employment, and they are going to be the employer of record for everybody. So everybody's going to run through the staffing agency, and the staffing agency will pay the individual.
We've been talking with the Labor Department's Kayla Rosenfeld, and that meeting she was talking about is on Kauai, October 11th in Hanalei. For links, check out our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks, Kuvehi and Wayne. You know, today's Reality Check is a segment where we feature stories from our partner, Honolulu Civil Beat. And this morning, we're joined from Washington, D.C. With reporter Nick Ruby. Today, we're talking ballast water. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
I understand you're out pounding the pavement this afternoon. It's morning here, but afternoon your time.
Yes, it's about rush hour here in our nation's capital. So I am out on the street, so hopefully you don't hear too many cars honking. They actually do that here, unlike back home.
Okay. Well, you know, ballast water, I hear that, and I think of my kids' science fair, because that was an exhibit. They were trying to tackle a real-world problem. So what's the story with ballast water today?
Yeah, so ballast water, just to sort of orient the listeners today, is the water that's held in the bottom of ships to help with balance and trim. And so when ships fill their ballast tanks, they're taking in ocean water. And when they're bringing this ocean water in, what comes along with it sometimes are plants and critters that then make the journey to wherever that ship is going. And then as the ships unload, that ballast water also is unloaded. And that can introduce new alien and invasive
species into an environment that it typically would not be in. A famous example is in the Great Lakes with zebra mussels, and those have caused quite a problem out there for the Great Lakes, not only changing sort of the makeup of the ecosystem and adding new algae into the environment, but also those mussels are clogging up water pipes, for instance. It can be a real big problem.
Right, so we don't want invasive species and we don't want pollution. So I understand that there was some legislation that you were tracking.
Yeah. So here in Washington, Democrats and Republicans were pushing a bill that would have created a single rule, a federal rule, to regulate ballast water discharges. And, unlike a lot of things in Washington, it did actually have bipartisan support, at least for a little while. Now, those who are with the shipping industry on one side, they thought that this was a great rule because it would make all of the regulation more streamlined, less onerous, and therefore result in a better bottom line for them. Environmentalists, however, were concerned with the way that the rules were written and that it would make it more difficult to sort of combat pollution and invasive species entering the waters. Basically, it would take the regulation out from under the purview of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Water Act and put it under the purview of the Coast Guard.
Okay, and I know, we've got such a big problem with invasive species out here.
Sure, right. Hawaii is often referred to as an invasive species capital. There are hundreds of invasives that are attributed at least to ballast water as well as other organisms that attach themselves to the bottom of ships and come here. But I think what's really interesting about this particular legislation are two things. One is that it was supported by U.S. Senator Brian Schatz, who then later voted against the legislation to help block it. And the other is that former state senator Willis Sparrow is now advocating legislation to sort of come back and pass. The thing is he admits that he was approached by a lobbying organization to push for this bill, but the interesting aspect of that is he's not saying who that organization is.
So this legislation, though, it didn't pass.
It did not pass, but that does not mean that it cannot come forward again. This is a bill that has come before Congress a number of times over the years, and I don't expect that to change anytime soon, especially with the commercial shipping industry still hoping to influence lawmakers here to get it done.
Right. Okay. So it's obviously an important issue that we'll have to track. All right. Thanks so much, Nick.
All right. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
That was today's Reality Check featuring reporter Nick Ruby from Washington, D.C. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. Curling. You may have watched the sport during coverage of the Olympics and know that USA won gold. Now, here in the islands, most people don't get a chance to see the sport in action. Members of the U.S. Olympic team that won a gold medal are in town to raise money for the Kahuiki Village, a model community that's taking shape off Nimitz Highway. It's thanks to American Savings Bank. It brought a couple of team members in to talk to a group of lucky grade school students from Mililani who took to the ice today. Olympic gold medalist Tyler George stopped by our studios yesterday afternoon to talk about his love of the sport.
It originated in Scotland about 400 years ago. They used to play on frozen ponds. Luckily, we don't have to do that. But you're basically throwing 42-pound granite stones down a sheet of ice that's over 100 feet long at a 12-foot bullseye, or house is what they call it. So you're really just trying to get your team's stones closer to the center of this target than the opposing team.
And so I imagine, since you're from Minnesota, that it's a big deal over there.
Yeah, in the Midwest as a whole, that's kind of the curling hotbed of the United States. Minnesota and Wisconsin would probably be where you'd see it the most. And it's pretty common in our home state, but it's still not particularly well known. we play in one of the nicest clubs in the country. We're very fortunate that, and a lot of the nicest facilities in the United States are in Minnesota and Wisconsin. But it's growing now, especially with our success at the Olympics. There's a lot more exposure, and we've really been doing as much as we can to travel around the country and be ambassadors for the sport and continue that that growth that we're seeing from Korea.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine, you know, since it's hit that competitive level, that now people are like, oh, maybe this is something that I could get into.
Yeah, especially because I think people watching on TV see us as relatable and kind of regular guys, which is exactly what we are, and they think that's something that they could do. And it's kind of similar to golf in that, where you could step onto the ice for the first time and throw a perfect shot, but can you do it again? Can you repeat it? And the same with golf. You could step onto the tee for the first time, hit a perfect drive, but could you do it over and over again? So it is something that anybody can do at any age. It just takes a lifetime to master, too.
And so how do you get fit or stay fit in order to curl?
It's a lot of endurance training, a lot of interval things. We, with our sweeping that we do on the ice with brooms, I'm sure people have seen, a lot of times you're putting all-out effort for 30 seconds at a time and then stopping for maybe a minute in between and then doing it again for another 30 seconds. So being able to get your heart pumping and keep your muscles going for different amounts of time with interval training is huge for us.
So it's like quick bursts of
yes
energy.
Yeah, exactly.
And so tell us about, you know, what you've been doing all this week with the kids here in Hawaii.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. We just went and visited the kids from Mililani Waena Elementary School. The kids were awesome. I think it was third and fourth graders that we spoke with and just explained the game of curling to them, showed off the gold medals, which they really liked, and they asked a lot of great questions, too. We deal with a lot of groups of kids in the travels that we've done and the speaking engagements that we've had. And these kids were some of the best that we've had as an audience. They really engaged, really excited about the sport. And I'm sure a part of that is because it's not something that they've had any experience with whatsoever. So just a really fun morning getting to do something like that, to grow the game and show a different part of the United States, our passion and our craft.
I mean, it's a real novelty, this sport.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of neat that every 4 years it tends to be a curiosity for people when they see it in the Olympics, and that's basically the only avenue the general public has of seeing curling outside of, you know, the Midwest and places where it's more common. But this time around, again, because we did as well as we did, we're seeing more of a passion for the game from people that may not have been familiar with it before. So events like these, where we can go to different parts of the country where they've never seen curling ice, let alone the sport itself. It's just really cool to see that passion continue to grow and clubs popping up all over the country over the last 5-10 years that would have never had it in the past. We've had national championships now in Florida. There's tournaments in Arizona, Texas, North Carolina, South Carolina. I mean, places where you never would have dreamed of seeing curling 10 years ago. So with what happened now in February, we're just seeing that escalate exponentially, and we're doing everything we can to keep that going.
What other countries is this sport kind of a big deal?
In Canada, it's huge. That's the top curling country on the planet, hands down. They have, I believe, about 1 million registered curlers in their clubs up there. And in the U.S., we have somewhere in the range of 23,000, but that number is growing fast now. It'll take us a long time to get to Canada, but really after hockey, curling is kind of their number two sport, even with television audiences. They have major curling events on all the time.
Yeah, so, they're nuts about hockey over there.
Yeah, they are. Hockey's always going to be number one. I can't see anything overtaking that. But curling is huge there. Scotland, obviously, it's big. That's where curling originated. They have a ton of clubs over there. Sweden, it's becoming more popular. A lot of the countries that are competing in the Olympics, the teams are few and far between, but they're heavily funded. Not the case in Canada, Scotland, countries like that. There's a lot of teams that are competing for a few spots. And even just with the registered club members and the recreational players, it's everywhere in Canada. There are cities that have 15 to 20 curling clubs in them, which you would never see in the U.S. You know, if we have 15 in a state, that'd be a lot.
And so tell us about the equipment. I mean, is it something very expensive to get into?
Not compared to other sports. If you're buying curling shoes like that are actually made for curling, then it's going to cost you a couple hundred dollars probably for those. And for a curling broom, the same thing. But that's really the extent of the equipment you need to play in a league. And if you're just starting out, before you get shoes, before you get brooms, usually at clubs in the U.S., they'll have club brooms that you can use and Teflon sliders that you can put over your shoes, too. So you don't necessarily have to have those shoes to start out with. You can try the game out, see if you like it, and then decide if you want to get that equipment, too.
Okay, because I know lots of sports, they have very technical material, you know, fabric and this, mm-hmm. that, and the other, and carbon fiber and this, yep. that, and the other. So, yeah, it's just kind of interesting to see what the difference is in a sport like this.
Yeah, and it's the same as any other sport with that. If you get serious about it, you're going to want the best equipment. But at a beginner level, you wouldn't need any of those things. That's just the next step that you take if you take the sport more seriously.
You've been working with the kids. Is there any reaction that you recall that, you know, when the kids were watching and learning about what you do, just what they were struck by?
The thing that surprised me the most was how many of them actually watched us at the Olympics. I would say over half of the kids that were there at least had some kind of exposure to it, which we weren't really expecting. So they were really interested to learn the rules. You know, they still weren't really sure what was going on while they're watching, but that goes for everybody that watches curling. And they picked up on it really quickly, too. And by the time we were done speaking with them, we told them, you now know more than 99% of the population of the United States about curling. And it was true. And just the excitement they had to learn about it and to meet us, and they were just like sponges. They, you know, it wasn't like a group of kids that were just waiting for the next class or just kind of getting through a speaker. You know, they were very engaged, and just the level of enthusiasm they had, I think, was the thing that we noticed the most.
And did you think when you were their age that you would be a curling champ?
I'd like to think so, yeah. I actually grew up in a curling club, so I've been around it my entire life. My parents ran the curling club in Duluth when I was born. So I get stories all the time, and I've said this a million times, from people in the club that remember seeing me sleeping in the roasting pans in the kitchen as an infant. So I'm literally raised on the game. And a lot of the people that I looked up to growing up were curlers, and that's an unusual thing too. But it's such a great community of people, such a tight-knit a group, not just in the United States but around the world. The Swedish guys that we played for the gold medal, two of them came to our teammates' wedding the previous summer. I played fantasy football against one of the guys in the Canadian team in a game this weekend. One of the Norwegian guys went over for his wedding a couple of years ago. Curlers themselves are just that tight-knit, and you get that sense even as a child growing up, and you decide that's the group of people I want to be around, not just that you want to succeed at the sport. And that's basically what kept me going and had me quit baseball, had me quit soccer, basketball growing up, because I just love being around that community of people so much. It always felt like it was my home.
And that was gold medalist Tyler George. Now, tonight's big fundraising event hosted by American Savings Bank is sold out. Participants just snatched up the rare chance to curl on the ice. The goal was $100,000 for Kahuiki Village to help homeless families. And that wraps up the conversation. Now back up to Pledge Central with Kuvehi and Wayne.